Michael and Loretta, winners of the drawing for Waiting for Columbus, the 8-CD collection autographed by the band Little Feet. They were randomly chosen from the 259 people who donated to KPFT during our Summer Sizzle membership drive between August 1 and August 13. And thank you to everyone who has donated to the station over the years. It's you who keep KPFT on the air.
And now stay tuned for Execution Watch, an exclusive service of community media. KPFT, Houston.
You're listening to KPFT, Houston, Texas. This is Houston's community radio station, serving our diverse communities for more than 50 years.
Due to the following special program, Execution Watch, Houston Jazz Spotlight Hour Number 1, will be preempted. Please join us for Hour Number 2 at 7 p.m. here on KPFT.
You're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM radio, Houston, Texas. Kasul Shantikamani is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Shantikamani to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Pat McCann. Huntsville report outside the death house, Linda Snyder, Clinton Young attorney Merrill Ponte, and Ali Sullivan, an ally of Shantikamani. The Execution Watch for Kasul Shantikamani begins.
Hello and welcome to our listeners around the world and on this Wednesday, August the 17th edition of Execution Watch, held whenever the state of Texas executes a prisoner. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for Jazz Spotlight with Tierney Malone, stay tuned for hour two following this program. As many as you know, KPFT 90.1 FM Houston is listener sponsored and currently in a fund drive. You can read all about it on their website at kpft.org. Tonight we bring you live news coverage as the state of Texas plans to execute Kasul Shantikamani, convicted in the stabbing death and robbery of 40-year-old Sarah Walker in McKinney, Texas, over 16 years ago. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, our chief legal analyst, Larry B. Douglas, and our special guest, criminal defense attorney Patrick McCann. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Larry, lead us off. Tell us what happened in this case, if you will. Kasul's attorneys challenged his conviction based on junk science. Tell us the story of how he got there first.
Well, back on July 8th of 2006, Sarah Walker, a realtor in McKinney, Texas. She was in a model home preparing to show the home, and she was killed. Now, the case reflects that she was a person who flashed a lot of jewelry, apparently. Mm. She had a brand new watch, and she had rings and so forth. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing that. But they make that a significant part of the case, saying that her ex-husband came over to visit her, and she just bought a brand new watch that she had on a nice ring that she went to the bank, and she was seen in the bank with the expensive watch on. And then she goes to her office, well, goes to the model home with the intention to show the model home. And she's talking to people on the phone, and she apparently hears a knock at the door or something. And she says, looks like I've got somebody at the door. So the next that is heard of her is about an hour or so later, when a person goes by to check, to go into the office, sees the door open, goes in, and finds her body. Now, Shantika Mon, well, there is a car in the neighborhood, a white Mustang, that there are supposed witnesses who pay attention to this car and notice that there appears to be a brown man who's in the car, seems to be a muscular build, and they see the car generally in the neighborhood. They, for whatever reason, pay close attention to the car. Now, there is some suggestion that these witnesses did not really remember any of that, did not remember the specifics, until they were placed under hypnosis. So after being placed under hypnosis, they came up with a description of the person they said they saw. And using that description, they take about a couple of months before they end up focusing on Mr. Kasol Shantika Mon, and then he was charged with, in McKinney, Texas, charged with her murder. Now, when the trial commences, it appears that, well, the prosecutor decided they want to seek the death penalty. Mm-hmm. That is a murder occurring during the course of a robbery. Now, robbery, they try to make robbery saying that she had these expensive things, and when we found her body, they were gone. And for Kasol Shantika Mon, they make the case that, well, he needed money because his bank account was low. So they use that to tie him into, along with the witness identifications, tie him into the murder.
Let me stop you for just a moment, and let's go with our reporter who is in Huntsville right now, Linda Snyder. Linda, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I know you've been with the Rev, and you've been with Kasol's mother, sister, and father most of the day. Linda, I can't see you. Is your camera on?
Yeah, there it is.
Okay, thank you very much. I know that you've been with the family for most of the day. How is everyone holding up?
Everyone's holding up as well as can be expected. His mother's taking it very hard, and his sister. But they just crossed the line now. His mother went in. So I was trying to get Larry to listen to me, but he didn't stop.
My apologies. That was my fault, not Larry's.
Okay.
I hear that your group, Death Penalty Action, has been very involved with Kasol. Can you tell us what your group has done, how the interaction has been?
Well, I want to let you talk to Allie about that because they have done so much for him.
Yeah.
We've done a lot, but let me put Allie on.
Thank you. We're going to be talking with Allie Sullivan. She's with Death Penalty Action. And hi, Allie.
Hi.
Hello, Allie. So we know you were great friends with Kasol. Can you tell us about him a little bit and your interaction with him?
I just want to start by saying Kasol is one of the most special people I've ever had the privilege of knowing. And as somebody who does this a lot, you can say that about a lot of the guys, but I think what's so particularly amazing about Kasol is the fact that in this case where he has proclaimed his innocence since he was arrested in 2006 for the murder of Sarah Walker, he has not become bitter. I think it would be very easy for people to become bitter, to become upset about their situation. And of course, Kosol is not happy about dying today, but he is just so full of gratitude for everybody that was able to support him and everybody that learned about his case and everybody that did something and believed him, or just, he is just so full of gratitude. And I think that really is a testament to his character and the fact that in this moment, he was less worried about himself and he's more worried about those that love him.
Ali, of course, Linda Snyder, our reporter, has just told us that the witnesses have crossed the road. And for our listeners, I want to explain that that's our signal that the execution has begun. It's getting ready to start.
Yes.
I believe you had a message from Kosol.
Yeah. So we had spoken about his last words earlier today, because I know those aren't publicized as much in Texas as they might be elsewhere. But Kosol first just wants to let everybody know, his family, his friends, those who have supported him, how much they mean to him. And as I said earlier, I just want to reiterate how much gratitude Kosol has for every single person, every single organization, every single influencer, every single person who's gone out of their way to try to save him. And of course, he does not want to die right now. And he is still proclaiming his innocence in that chamber back there. But he is okay if this means that Sarah Walker's family can find closure. He says he did not kill Sarah Walker, but if his death brings them closure, then he's okay with it.
Well, this is a very difficult time and a very difficult day. And thank you, Ali. We appreciate what's going on and you being a witness to this and being a friend. And I know that the Death Penalty Action, your group, is doing great work. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you don't mind, we will get back to Linda when they come out and do a little bit more. I hear the death knell going over there, so let's continue on with our conversation a little bit. You said, let's talk about the trial.
Well, just in terms of facts, the murder was a very brutal murder. This woman was stabbed 33 times. She was also subject to some blunt force trauma, believed to have been inflicted by a potted plant or something of that sort. And she was also bitten. So the state makes its case suggesting that there is some scientific evidence that would tie him to the offense by the bite marks. And so they made a real big deal about that, and that's science has just shown to be just totally unreliable. But that was part of the state's case against him, would be the bite mark evidence. The DNA evidence was certainly a part of it, and he had been mentioned before, he denied having committed this murder at all. Now, there was some DNA tied to him from the hands and fingernails of Sarah Walker. The way that it was collected at that time, which was sort of the science at the time, they used one swab and swabbed different portions of the hand, mm-hmm. under the fingernails and other portions of the hand. And he initially claimed he'd never been there. And then he indicated that he had gone into, there was some evidence supposedly that he had admitted having gone into the mobile home to get a drink of water. Well, the model home. Well, I've heard it called mobile home and model home, but whichever it was, to get a drink of water. So he did supposedly admit that he was present at the scene. So with that, the DA's office proceeded against him with a capital murder case. And the case itself, they hit him with everything. Yeah. From the very beginning, even the judge showed so much deference to the prosecuting attorney by introducing him to the jury, as judges introduce attorneys to the jury all the time, but this introduction just was way over the top. Calling the prosecuting attorney, who is the elected district attorney. So he's saying, he's informing the citizens that they are now here having a case that is presented by your elected district attorney that he referred to as judge, because the district attorney had been a judge before. Then he goes into his whole background, saying he's a great guy. He's from a whole family of lawyers. See, because his son's a lawyer. In fact, his son's a judge now. And say, but judge, you know, my favorite, and he's got a daughter-in-law is a lawyer. Say, now she's my favorite one. And he goes all into background of the judge to reportedly inform the citizens of county that this is your elected DA who's trying this case in your presence. He also indicates that, you know, I've also tried cases with the defense lawyer, but nowhere near the kind of glowing recommendation, descriptions that he gave to the prosecuting attorneys. Now that should, when you get snowballed like that, in this attorney's defense, it's hard to figure out, you know, what do I do? Okay, right now, in order to perfect error, he would have had to object at the time. He did not, but he did file an objection later on before the jury was impaneled, but it was to no avail. Mm-hmm. All along, Kasul has claimed his innocence, but he was found guilty by the jury, and at the punishment phase, he was given the death penalty. He did have one prior conviction from North Carolina. I think it was an ag robbery that he was sentenced to 11 years for, and he got out of prison and had moved from North Carolina to the Dallas area.
So what is the status of his appeals, like, to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals? Anything?
He was denied relief from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals on Monday. Mm-hmm. And that same day, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles denied his request for a 120-day stay so that they could retest the DNA. And the DNA has been a primary focus of the latest round of attacks on his conviction and sentence. As Larry pointed out, this started with junk science, and it's ending with, if not junk science, a pretty bad execution of science that could have been done better. And
this, what do you mean?
Well, first, even proponents of DNA have admitted that for the last several years, they've been misleading people because of an error in their mathematical probability statistics. Oftentimes, the reports will assess a probability of whether or not this is someone else, and those probabilities will be expressed in extraordinary numbers, usually grouped by racial populations that do not exist anywhere outside of social science. And they go something like this: the probabilities of this being matched to another person are 1,000,000,002 in Hispanics, 1,000,000,001 if the person is black, and 1,000,000,000 even if it's a Caucasian. The problem is that no one actually knows what those mean. And first off, they admit that they got their math wrong on the mixtures, And we have been getting admissions from most of the labs accredited that there were significant mistakes in their processing and handling of DNA mixtures, such that it could now, be excluded from review, that someone that would have tested as, someone they could not exclude 20 years ago could now be excluded. And the other part of this is that they often do not report on what the mixture is, because if the sample is either inadequate or degraded, it does not provide sufficient genetic material for them to test. And here's where this matters for Kusul's case. This is about bad science and bad investigation from the start. Bite marks as a forensic science have been completely discredited because they don't work. And in fact, cases have been reversed for that. Hypnosis to obtain testimony. I hesitate to even dignify it with the word parlor trick, but let's call it that and say that's not what you're supposed to base a conviction on. Those were attacked, as Larry said, in the earlier habeas writs years ago, and resulted in the case coming back to the trial court. And the trial court found that the DNA, once you excluded the other bad science, the DNA was fine. Problem is that the DNA is not fine. The last couple of rounds of habeas work by the lawyers on his case have attacked specifically the fact that what people thought was the potential murder weapon, a planter, as Larry had mentioned, apparently may not even contain her DNA. At least that's the allegation. The other part is that the mixture analysis that they did would now come out in a different way. And that they also raised the possibility of something called transfer, which is that in the collection of this, that nobody thought to screen out for transfer, which is when you touch something and I touch something you touched and the DNA that's on there transfers. And it's, if his story is correct and true, and she gave him a glass of water, well, that kind of explains how any genetic material got on her hand. But we get down to this fundamental issue. Under 11.073 of our Code of Criminal Procedure, you can bring a scientific attack that attacks the conviction if the science has changed. This is the part where the rubber meets the road. The problem is that they've made a good allegation on his defense that this would not have come out the same way. And none of this was ever presented to the jurors. So what would be the harm in a stay? Respectfully, this man is not or wasn't going anywhere. And if you wanted to be sure, we've already eliminated significant portions of the state's case through bite marks, through hypnotic, whatever one calls horse manure these days. And now you're left with DNA that's vulnerable. Why not stop and pause and do the things that get you to a place of at least moral certainty that you've got the right person, if that's what you're trying to uphold? Honestly, it's rare to sit there and see someone who has maintained innocence the entire time. It is even more rare to find this many holes in a state's case, and yet we found it, and yet here we are going forward on an execution. Now, even if you put the burden on the defense to raise these issues and prove it as much as you can, you have certainly gotten to a place where the sentence should be considered and the evidence should be re-examined. But that appears to be too late, as we are now, because unfortunately it doesn't appear there are any last minute pleadings at this point. The lawyers did attempt to take this up to the Supreme Court last year. That was denied. The clemency has been denied, and the last under the rules now, one has to have the last pleading in a week before the execution. So at this point, it does not appear that there would be good cause for them to have filed anything else, and it appears to be going forward.
So even without moral certainty in this particular case, the state has checked the boxes and are going to execute him no matter what?
They believe they've always had the right person despite the problems with their case. They believe that now, and they're certainly not going to admit that they don't. I would hope that either the board or the governor or the reviewing court might have looked at this differently, but again, there seems to be a strong push for this execution that objectively a 120-day stay, whether by the Court of Criminal Appeals or by the Board of Pardons and Paroles, would not have harmed, because it would have provided adequate time to retest the DNA,
right,
or reexamine how it was done, at least provide some check on what people are hanging their hat upon. And it does not seem that they're willing to do that.
Now, we know that Sarah Walker's father, Joe Walker, who is has passed on at this point in time, but he made a video saying he forgave. There was no malice in his heart. When families don't want them to do the death penalty, why is it still pushed so hard?
In my opinion, because although the victims and the family are often invoked by our elected politicians, this is a political decision. It is not, if they don't want it, it doesn't matter. If they do want it, it's publicized in the paper. So if there is a genuine concern for the families about these issues, I think it is only rarely invoked by the district attorneys who seek these executions, and only rarely considered by the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. And that's one of the frustrations on this, is that clemency is so rarely granted that it's almost like a lightning strike if it happens. It's so rare. There's no clear guidance. There's no clear way forward to get there because there are no published decisions. There are no real guidelines. And it's frankly, since all of them are appointees of this current governor, it's frankly the governor's wish or will what happens. And that's a sad statement that, you know, mercy in this governor is reserved for, frankly, rich white people.
There seems to be a lot of question, especially about the fact that, of course, Kosol is Laotian. And that does, it's not something that we run into on a regular basis in our system. And of course, there's also been remarks coming from some of the jurors who said that they would not have voted him guilty in this particular case had some of these DNA evidence been presented differently.
Larry, you want to take that?
Well, for one, the science has changed. It's getting better and better all the time. The real opportunity that a defendant has for surviving the state seeking death penalty is really on the at the jury trial level. And so they hit them with pretty much everything on the trial level, including even the junk science bite mark. They went further than just bringing the supposed scientific evidence about the bite mark into the trial. They even introduced a photo of Kosol acting as though he was getting ready to bite a dog. So the overreaching is just tremendous. Okay. Now, and the judge let that in.
Where was this trial?
This is in McKinney, Texas, a little bit north of Dallas.
Collin County?
Collin County, yes. Right. Yeah. Now, the appeals court said, well, that was error. Okay. And so even in the cases where you find that there was error, the courts tend to say, well, but the error was harmless. It didn't do any harm at all. So they really loaded him up at the trial court level with just overwhelming suggestions of guilt. And that is then placed into the minds of the jurors, which is where we got here talking about what the jurors believe.
Right.
Once the jurors make their decisions, typically it's hard to shake them. Even if you take, well, you've got the DNA, okay, that's continuing. But the bite mark evidence, not good enough. Yeah, but still, we didn't need that. The hypnosis for the identification, well, we didn't need that. But the DNA is what we're hanging our hats on. But if the DNA, if there are some defects in the DNA, or at least a desire, or at least a possibility that further testing of the DNA might suggest that the guilt has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, it doesn't do any harm to take some time and take a look at that. Now, being a Laotian, the fact that the DNA, that raises the question of the availability of population evidence
right.
for DNA right. For Laotians,
yeah.
because it's just not there. And so they have to look to other populations to try to figure out what to do with that.
The time is now 6:30 here in Houston, Texas. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us. This is Execution Watch. If you tuned in for Tierney Malone's Jazz Spotlight at the top of the hour, you can hear the second hour of that show. On the last edition of Execution Watch, we were able to talk with Clinton Young, who had recently been released from death row. Mr. Young was scheduled to make another appearance here today, but on August the 13th, Clinton Young's defense lawyers learned that prosecutors had obtained a second indictment, this time in Harrison County, for the same offense in which Clinton is already facing trial in Midland County. Let's bring in our special guest via Zoom of Merrill Pointier, a defense attorney for Clinton Young, specializing in capital punishment. Merrill, what's happened to Clinton since he was on execution watch? Just a moment. Merrill, unmute, please, darling. Thank you. Okay.
I'm sorry. So as of the last execution watch, and for the past 7 months, ever since Clint got out, he had been complying with all of his bond conditions.
Mm-hmm.
He was working, he was doing really well. And last Friday, when he was out on a job and on his way to Louisiana, he was in Mississippi, and he got arrested on another indictment for capital murder. And it turned out that the AG's office presented another case to the grand jury in Harrison County for one of the two murders that he is already indicted for in Midland County. So he now is now indicted for two murders, and one of those murders he's indicted for twice, and both of these indictments are with the AG's office. And they set his bond yesterday at $5 million.
Wow. Where is Clinton now?
Since he got arrested in Mississippi, he spent the weekend at a jail there until Harrison County came and got him Monday morning. So he is now in a Harrison County jail.
Well, what's next in the legal process for Clinton?
Well, we need to see if this indictment can even stand. There's all kinds of questions about how they went about it and how they got this indictment. And the $5 million bond is basically no bond. And bond is meant to ensure the defendant's presence at trials and court hearings, but Clinton had never missed one in the past 7 months. So there's really no need to get a $5 million bond, because on the $150,000 bond that he had, he was complying with everything, and he was appearing for any pretrial hearing. So there's no need for this $5 million bond, so we're attacking that too.
Well, thank you. Are you still working with the Clinton Young Foundation?
Yes, absolutely. So working with that, we have other clients, although this case gets most media attention, especially now. But yeah, I'm still working with that foundation.
Thank you so much. And of course, people can go to their website to find out more about what's going on. Thank you, Meryl. We appreciate you giving us a update on Clinton, and please give him our best.
I will do so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Of course, we are concerned about Clinton Young, but we are also, at this moment, waiting to hear the last of what's happening with Kasul Chandakamane. What she just told us is absolutely mind-boggling to me. I've always heard that there was a double jeopardy. You couldn't try somebody for the same case, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Explain it to me.
Don't confuse double jeopardy with an additional murder, or if it's a new attack on the same case, if the case is reversed, doesn't mean it's always reversed and dismissed. A habeas writ simply places you where you were prior to the case being tried, back at the stage of, let's say, indictment. And unless the grounds were actual innocence, in which case you could bring a writ for stalling this for double jeopardy, a procedural ground such as ineffective assistance of counsel or misbehavior by the state, while it's a strong recommendation that you not pursue the case by the appellate courts, it's not necessarily going to stop them from going forward to save face.
To save face. You know, I I'm sorry to bring up something else other than Kasul, but last month the state of Alabama's execution of Joe Nathan James Jr. may have taken longer than any other lethal injection in recorded American history, lasting somewhere between 3 and 3.5 hours. How is that not cruel and unusual punishment?
Well, that unfortunately, that Oklahoma case that shut down the lethal injection
right.
group lawsuit about the combination of the drugs.
Right.
Combined with the fact that Alabama now offers, and this is almost laughable, it's so darkly, grimly Kafka-esque,
yeah.
is they offer inmates a choice of execution methods now. And if you are concerned about the lethal injection protocol, you can choose gas, is my understanding.
Ugh.
And other states are copying that.
I have heard that some have resorted back to the firing squad.
I mean, as ugly as that is, it is at least swift.
Let's go back to our reporter outside of the death house, Linda Snyder. Linda, tell us what's happening, please.
Nope. She's gone.
She'll be back in just a moment, but I do believe that there is evidence that the witnesses have come back out of the death house and have crossed the road, so... at this point in time, I believe it's safe to say that the execution of Kasul Chandakamane is over. And Linda, darling, can you hear us?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Okay, so what has happened? The witnesses have come back across the road?
Yes, they crossed the road, come back, going back into the other building. So it's over, I guess.
Can you please explain to our listeners what happens now?
Well, what happens now is his body will go to the church, and we're going to the church, and that'll be the first time we get to touch him. That's the first time we get to touch him and hug him, you know, and say our goodbyes, and we're touching him.
Right. I thank you for your eyewitness account. I appreciate all that you have done. Thank you so much, Linda. You are listening, of course, to Execution Watch. We are broadcasting live from KPFT 90.1 FM and here at Houston Media Source in their beautiful studios. Gentlemen, it just seems like there's no logic to this.
I think trying to impose logic on the death penalty is a mistake. It's not a logical legal decision. It is a political one that involves human beings that are often targeted and convicted on bad evidence or evidence that's weak, or people that are horribly damaged who stumble into the criminal system in a tragic way. And to ease people's fears, politicians kill those that we don't like.
And
I'm sorry if that sounded a little bit fiery, but it's been a long time since that Larry and I have been watching this, and I don't have another explanation for a lot of the things that have happened.
Well, this is what you do. This is what you observe. Is the death machine slowing down, gearing up?
It's slowed, but Larry, you saw the 13 federal executions at the end of Trump's deal, and that had been halted for,
right,
you know, a couple of decades.
As Patrick mentioned, it is political, and it seemed to have been slowing down, but things can change, okay, rapidly. Now with life without parole, that would seem to be a way of avoiding these kinds of things, because at least with a life without parole, if there is some new evidence that should be discovered, then that might be reversed. But death is just totally irreversible.
It's over.
As lawyers, we tend, in all cases, to suggest to our clients not to talk at all. Now, I have no idea whether any kind, I hope, I pray, that the discussion that Clinton Young had with anybody did not result in, had nothing to do with the position the government's taking now. But we have interviewed people on death row ourselves, and it's, that process is just replete with all kinds of risks on their parts. Now, I know we, as a broadcast organization, the desire to inform the public is something that we'd like to be able to do. But it can cause some problems. And when you're in the system, this is a totally unforgiving system. And when you're in it, it's almost always best to keep your mouth shut. It can cause some bad problems for you when you speak up.
You know, we have Linda Snyder still outside of the death house right now. And Linda, you were a friend of Casals. Could you just tell us a little bit about him?
Casal was a very nice person. I love him to pieces. I've been seeing him since 2014. And this is very hard on me because I lost a friend. And, you know, I'm sad. Today he was very calm. That's why it's hard for me to believe that he fought, you know, like they say he did. But tomorrow I will find out, because I'm making a visit tomorrow at the unit. So the guys will tell me if anything happens. The rev said he didn't fight once he got in the chamber here. He did not fight. So
he was very, very calm.
So I think somebody's just trying to stir up something. But then again, maybe he did fight. Hopefully he did, but too bad he didn't kill him. I should say that, I guess.
What did the guys on the row say about him?
They liked him. They felt sad for him. You know, they didn't want to see him go, but yet they said, you know, who wants to live on the row the rest of their life?
Right.
But it's not any fun either when a death row guy goes to GP, because the GP people don't like him when they get in GP. They don't like him because they got off death row, you know. It's really, really bad.
And when you say GP, you're actually talking about general population?
Yes, and that's where they go whenever they get off the road. They get, you know, life.
Right.
I know several guys that have gone to life, and they're really not that happy. They also miss the guys that they were friends with on the road, because they said it doesn't. It's not. They're not friends there. They're, you know, everybody's like enemies with each other. They don't fall. They don't form a friendship like they did on death row. They were like a family on death row.
What is life like on death row? Are they in isolation? Do they get?
Yes, they're in isolation. Yes.
For how many hours?
And they're not treated good by a lot of the guards.
So that can always be that problem. I know this is hard for you, Linda. I'm sorry, and I really appreciate the fact that you're talking with us and letting people around the world know what's happening here in Texas. So you, of course, have spent most of the day with Casol's mother, who was the eyewitness. I assume you're going to go and spend this next time with her in the church when they remove the body. Is that
yes? We're fixing to go to the church right now.
And is the Rev with you? Is he there?
Yes. Do you want to talk to him?
I'd like to. Yes, please.
Okay, Rev. Good to see you right here and talk to them. That's the prison. Now, excuse me. Turn around that way and face the wall.
Oh, okay.
Hello, Rev. I know.
Yeah,
that,
hi there.
Hi. We know that you have been the spiritual advisor for Casol.
Yes.
Do you have anything to tell us about him?
I did see him again before, you know, we left. I saw him for about 15, 20 minutes maybe. And then I went back into another room and waited for him. And then I didn't see him again until they escorted me into the chamber. When I got there, of course, he was already ready. There has been some rumors, I don't know, that he fought with the guards on the way before he got into the chamber. I kind of find that very odd, because he was too calm when I saw him before then. So anyway, I went in. There were two other TDCJ employees there. And then I stepped forward and said my prayers. And then he gave a brief statement, you know, thanking TDCJ, you know, for their kindness, and that he apologized to the family and hoped that his death then would, you know, appease their pain. But it seemed like it took a really long time. I got there somewhere between 5 and 10 after, but they didn't pronounce him dead until 6:33. So, and then I, after the doctor left, I went over to him, closed his eyes, said a prayer, and then I left at that point.
And, of course, you were able to be there now in the chamber because you were his spiritual advisor, and Texas has reversed itself on that rule. Is that correct?
Yeah, they changed that earlier this year. Because since 2019, no one's been able to go in to the chamber except TDCJ. So I think it was like March or April, I think is when they started allowing us in there.
Well, Rev, thank you very much. Thank you. If you don't mind, give us back to Linda for just a moment. And the connection is sort of breaking up. I understand that, and I apologize for that. We are fortunate to be able to broadcast from different locations, which is really something else. Thank you, Linda. I know you have things to do. I appreciate you again. Please, thank you, Linda. I appreciate all you do. And we have lost your audio, so please go and be with the family. And thank you. Thank you very much. Let's bring it back here into the studio with Pat and Larry. Of course, the fact that the Rev was there is a difference. There seems to be so many little cruelties that the state of Texas has enforced, like no more last meal. For a time, they didn't allow a spiritual advisor to be in the room or to touch the prisoner. But they've reversed some of these things. Why?
Well, the Supreme Court, whatever one may think of this current court, they have a deep interest in religious freedom, and to them, denying someone the comfort of a spiritual advisor at the last moment was a direct assault on the First Amendment, in addition to simply being morally cruel.
And that also just underscores the importance of the political influence on pretty much everything, but particularly on cases like these. It's the political atmosphere that in every single circumstance, especially including the initial trial. This was a trial where, well, in every criminal case that the prosecutor has a tremendous amount of discretion as to whether to even bring the case to begin with. This could easily, I mean, it was a brutal murder, absolutely. But have there been brutal murders where this would just be a murder case? There have been. I don't have any idea how well connected she might have been politically, but this was a case that when you look at the case reported itself, they went after him with, well, when you go after somebody with what is trending to be junk science, to the degree that they did, the dog, the biting the dog, the hypnosis, some of those things are just seemingly suspect. But if it's part of the, if it has not been disproven, if it's being still used, as a defense lawyer, you just have to deal with it. But that those things made things really, really difficult, and they went after them all, very strenuously, to the intention of getting him convicted and seeking the death penalty is, it's partly politically motivated, and so it's something we just always have to make sure that. That we focus on the political side too.
And of course, we're in a very political year here in Texas with the governor up for re-election. We had an execution on the same day that Governor Abbott signed what they call the heartbeat bill. So it's okay if you were an unborn child, but we can still put you to death. This on the same day seems very confusing.
It's not confusing if you look at who he's trying to appeal to. Again, this is, it's a political decision to seek the death penalty. It's a political decision to seek death, defend death, and to seek an execution. It only happens when a prosecutor seeks a warrant for execution. They have to seek a death date. And this is the struggle that, realistically, this will be faced by other district attorneys and judges in the near future. In fact, there's a case now by Seth Kretzer, who's up at the CCA, on the very issue of whether or not a judge who has to sign the execution order, whether that's a simple ministerial duty they don't have any discretion on, or whether they can say, nope, I'm going to allow you to seek to prove that he's insane or discover new DNA, whether the trial court judge has that discretion under our law. And that's going to go up to the CCA, so that's going to be an interesting new twist on this because Mr. Ramirez's execution is, I believe, set in the near future.
He has a date for October the 5th.
That's right.
Actually, I just want to ask a silly and stupid question we always see in all the old movies, that the governor is able to save the inmate at the last minute with a reprieve.
May I take this one, Larry?
Absolutely.
Okay. The governor has appointed every single member of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. Under our Constitution, he or she cannot act unless the board gives a favorable review. There is no statute that prevents the governor from making his intentions known. Now, he's appointed mostly ex-law enforcement to this board, so one would realistically expect that a significant number of commutations, grants of life, would be denied. But to give you a perspective, last year, non-capital clemencies, there were 140 applications to the board for people who had committed various crimes, from drugs to robbery. The board approved 75 of them, then withdrew recommendations on 25 of them. Of the remaining, the governor granted 8.
Wow.
So, like
just
I said,
amazing.
Not a very favorable system.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It is time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us on October the 5th when Texas plans to usher John Ramirez into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing with our live news coverage. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, we are on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org, where you can also get into our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Thank you. Thank you so much, gentlemen. I appreciate you. And special guest Merrill Pontier and Pat McCann, our panel Larry Douglas, our legal advisor, our Death House reporter Linda Snyder, Ali Sullivan from Death Abolition, and executive producer Elizabeth Stein, KPFT and Pacifica executive producer and technical advisor Otis McClay, and Houston Media Source video director Mark Pirtle. For those listening live on KPFT 90.1 FM, stay tuned for the second hour of Tierney Malone's Houston Jazz Spotlight. And on behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.
No matter what they tell you, you're tuned to Community Media 90.1 KPFT FM, FM HD1 Houston. This is Interim General Manager Sandy Wyman happily announcing that KPFT has satisfied its goal for the summer sizzle. It took a little extra time or a little extra sizzle to get there. I want to thank everybody that's worked on this drive, that's helped to make this goal. It puts us in a good position to go all the way into October, and by that point, we should be live and on the air in our new studios on Caroline Street. There'll be some schedule changes that I hope that you'll enjoy, but until then, well, we're just going to keep on trucking and building that studio, and we can go forward with these dollars that have been contributed. So, again, thanks. And now here's Robin Lewis to tell you who won those Little Feet box sets.
Congratulations to Michael and Loretta, winners of the drawing for Waiting for Columbus, the 8-CD collection autographed by the band Little Feet. They were randomly chosen from the 259 people who donated to KPFT during our Summer Sizzle membership drive between August 1 and August 13. And thank you to everyone who has donated to the station over the years. It's you who keep KPFT on the air.
If you feel like joining over 300 of your friends and neighbors that contributed to our drive, call 713-526-5738 or hit the donate button at kpft.org. The extra funds can be put to very good use, I assure you. Again, thanks everybody for your support. Peace. It's Friday night. The inmates go quiet. Listen.
it's time to holler down the pipe chase and rattle them bars.
The Prison Show airs Fridays 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT. For over 40 years, the show has connected Texas prison inmates with their friends and loved ones over the airwaves. You can't find an older Texas show, and it's right here on KPFT at 90.1 FM KPFT, Houston.
This is 90.1 KPFT.